This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A Kentucky nursing home saw an outbreak of COVID-19 with dozens infected, nearly half of whom had been vaccinated. And the state is also working to reach younger people with the message to get a COVID vax. We start the weekly news review today with Courier Journal reporter Deborah Yetter. Deborah, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well. So glad you could be with us today. I'm thinking back several weeks ago, a couple of months ago, when Governor Andy Beshear announced that there had been this COVID outbreak at a nursing home where some of the people infected had been vaccinated, and how disheartening it was to hear that, because we were learning about the vaccine still, how effective they would be, and to hear that vaccinated people had contracted COVID, what was a little bit scary. But it turns out, in reading your reporting, that these vaccines were extraordinarily effective in quelling what could have been a much worse disaster at this nursing home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a very interesting development. We didn't know a lot about it initially, but it turned out that it triggered an investigation by the CDC, who looked into what turned out to be a variant or a mutation of the virus introduced into this nursing home. As it turned out, an unvaccinated worker. And when the CDC report came out, it pointed out that although I think 46 people altogether, residents and staff, had been infected with this variant, the majority of them didn't have any symptoms or few symptoms at all because they had been vaccinated. They attribute the success to the vaccination. There were three deaths, two residents who were not vaccinated and one who was, but may have had other health conditions as well. But it turned out to be a pretty good example of how the vaccine is effective in protecting people even against variants that may pop up as time goes on.
And that's because this is primarily the most vulnerable population during this entire pandemic. It's the older people, particularly those in these types of nursing home environments. Your reported cited 46 cases of COVID-19 identified at this nursing home, 26 residents, 20 workers. 18 of those residents and 4 of the workers had been vaccinated. What do we know about how this variant entered the facility?
We don't know a lot. They say it was brought in. They traced it back through the CDC and state public health investigation to a worker who had not been vaccinated. They say the variant has not been previously identified in Kentucky, and it had some similarities to the variants identified in the United Kingdom and South Africa, but was not identical to them. In the CDC language, it's not one of concern, meaning they don't believe it's as widespread or, I guess, potentially dangerous as the other better known variants.
We didn't know exactly which nursing home had been impacted by this variant. The state had not released that information publicly. You obtained the details through an open records request. What can you tell us about what and where it is?
Yeah, I asked the state about it. It turned out to be the Life Care Center in Moorhead, Kentucky, in Rowan County. That's in eastern Kentucky. And that's part of it's operated by a chain out of Tennessee, the Life Care of America. They operate about 200 nursing homes in a number of states. And the Dr. Stack, Kentucky's public health commissioner, has basically praised the facility for its cooperation with the investigation and indicated they weren't particularly at fault here. It was, in fact, the fact that they had so many people vaccinated was, I think not maybe 90% of the residents were vaccinated, that was a testament to the efficacy of the vaccine in protecting people who even become infected from more serious illness.
Deborah, there does appear to be a disparity, however, in the percentage of nursing home residents who have been vaccinated and the percentage of nursing home workers who have been vaccinated. What can you tell us about that?
This is true, and it's an ongoing source of great concern for the state public health people and nursing home administrators. At this point, they're not requiring the vaccine. They're only strongly encouraging it for staff. Residents have been pretty eager for the uptake because, you know, it's about a third of the state's deaths now occurred in nursing facilities. It did take a terrible toll on the older, more vulnerable folks. So I think more than 70% of Kentucky residents of nursing homes have been vaccinated. However, only about 44% of staff have agreed to take the vaccine, and they attribute that in part to some fears or hesitancy about it among younger people who work in these facilities, and also maybe just need for more access and education. The feds did a series of clinics at the nursing homes on site but those ended in March, and now people have to go elsewhere to get the vaccine.
You did talk to someone for your reporting on this, Tim Vino, president of Leading Age Kentucky, an organization that represents nursing homes and other providers, and he suggested that these types of on-site clinics that were there early on in the vaccination process should probably resume to make them more accessible to workers, right?
Right. And that's part of the federal initiative, too. I think everyone realizes they need to make vaccines more easily obtainable and more accessible at the worksite or wherever. And the feds and the state are working to get vaccines back into the nursing homes with pharmacy companies that they use already. If they can get the feds to ship directly to them, they can take the supplies to the nursing homes and administer them on site to anyone who's willing to take the vaccine, employees or residents.
Right now, the vaccines are optional for nursing home residents or staff members. Where is the state on possibly reviewing whether it should be mandated?
Well, there's still some question about that. And while some places have elected to make them mandatory or a condition of employment, including one senior living company based here in Kentucky, Atria, it now requires vaccines as a condition of employment. Most nursing home operators are continuing to make them strongly encouraged. And the state has, Governor Andy Beshear has said they do not intend to make them mandatory at this point.
We're talking with Deborah Yetter, a reporter at the Courier-Journal in Louisville. On the other end of the age spectrum, Deborah, there's a focus on younger people and how do we get the vaccine into their arms. And so the state is trying to figure out ways to target what we have learned to call Generation Z. I understand that right now Kentucky is at about 1.75, 1.8 million vaccinations distributed to residents, but more than 70% of them are 40 or older. And so now the state is trying to get younger people excited. What are they doing?
Well, they're trying a lot of techniques trying to reach young people where they are. Now that anyone 16 or older is eligible for the vaccine, they really would like to see an increase in uptake among that group. Because even if they aren't as risk of serious illness or as much at risk of serious illness, they can transmit COVID. So the problem is a lot of these young people they're discovering get their information from social media like TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat. And so the traditional public service announcements and commercials on TV of people urging you to roll up your sleeves and get vaccinated may not work. So they're trying more novel approaches, including some social media ads. They recently held a vaccine clinic at a soccer stadium here in Louisville, which drew some young people to it with the promise of a free ticket. And they're looking at other ways to get the message out and reach out into communities where younger folk are likely to be found.
Are we going to see Governor Beshear doing one of those TikTok dances as an effort to get these kids interested?
I don't know if Governor Beshear will, but a professor at U of L suggested to me they work with influencers who kids might actually watch and maybe not just, you know, roll their eyes up.
Well, when we think about disinformation on the internet, it's not necessarily young people that come to mind first, but it does appear that there is, as you noted, some disinformation about vaccines going around on TikTok. What impact is that having on Kentucky young people, especially the ones that you spoke to?
Well, I talked to a high school class of Central kids who are in the Central High School here in Louisville, who are in pre-med studies, actually, and would have a little more working knowledge of, you think of, you know, sort of science and medicine. But even they had been alarmed by the stuff they were seeing on TikTok. And these kids, I mean, they're telling me they spend 6 to 8 hours a day on social media. It's not just, you know, an occasional thing for them. And their teacher became so concerned, she made him do a research paper about how the vaccines actually work, which brought a lot of them around. But from social media, they had been seeing a lot of the myths and the scary stories and the rumors that had basically influenced their thinking.
We're talking with Deborah Yetter, a reporter at the Courier-Journal in Louisville. So we talked about possibly giving tickets, you know, to a soccer game. There are other states that maybe Kentucky is looking at seeing some of the offers that are being made to young people. West Virginia, for example, is doing something unique. Do we know if efforts like what West Virginia Governor Jim Justice is doing with giving a $100 savings bond to anyone 16 to 35 who gets vaccinated? Do we know yet if these are working?
I think it's a little bit early to tell yet in terms of numbers. I think they've had a little bit of success with them. New Jersey, for example, is talking about offering a shot and a beer, getting a free craft beer if you get your shot. I don't know if Kentucky's laws would permit that. Governor Beshear sort of hedged on that question when he was asked directly about it, about what the state could do in terms of incentives. There may be some restrictions, but he did hint that they're working with private businesses and other partners who might offer direct incentives, like the free tickets to the soccer game last week, and do that and instead of having to go through government, go through maybe private employees or businesses or other entities.
One group of young people, Deborah, that will be vaccinated by the time they go back to school in the fall are students at Berea College. That is the first Kentucky institution of higher learning to require vaccinations. Tell us about their thinking on that.
Berea is the first and only college so far in Kentucky to require students. And I talked with the president about that a little bit today, as a matter of fact, Lyle Roloffs. And he said that basically they want to go back to a normal campus life where they can have students in the dining hall and the dorms and classrooms, you know, free and openly discussing curriculum without having to do it on Zoom and not having hybrid schedules with half the students in class, half online. And he said, ultimately, they concluded the only realistic way to do that was to require students to be vaccinated. Now, students who choose not to can still take classes online, but they decided that it was just time to go ahead to get back to the life they wanted on campus, require that.
What are the larger universities doing about it?
Right now, the larger universities in Kentucky are strongly encouraging it. I don't know if that could change at some point or if that's just going to be their policy. If they figure they can get enough students vaccinated, it'll work. But that's where most colleges and universities stand. However, around the country, other larger systems are starting to require vaccinations. I know Notre Dame, for example, in Indiana, Duke, which had a big outbreak here in the spring, are now making vaccines mandatory for fall.
And regardless of whether vaccines will be mandatory, we see that the University of Kentucky, for example, will be welcoming students back to residential life, the dorms, to put it shortly, that they're going to be back to pre-pandemic life in the fall.
Right. They had restricted occupancy in their residence halls to try to, I guess, keep those social distance all of last year. They said they'll be returning to normal occupancy in the fall at the residential halls. And I presume that means sorority and fraternity houses as well.
We're talking with Deborah Yetter, a reporter at the Louisville Courier-Journal. Let's talk now about this Baptist organization that has refused a state contract from the state to provide care for abused and neglected kids. Tell us about Sunrise Children's Services and this conflict that's going on.
Sunrise Children's Services, which is affiliated with the Kentucky Baptist Convention, has long been a provider of care for children who've experienced abuse and neglect. They have therapy, they have foster care, they have residential centers, and they are pretty well regarded in terms of a care provider for children's services. However, they're at an impasse with the state over wording in the contract that they have to sign for to continue providing those services for the coming year. And while they wouldn't say exactly what it is, it appears to hinge upon a requirement that you can't discriminate based on sexual orientation, as well as other factors, I presume race, religion, you know, so forth. Sunrise claims that in the past, the state was willing to overlook the provision they object to, but they are not this year. And so therefore, they have declined to enter into a contract with Kentucky, although they're still hoping to persuade them otherwise. Kentucky, for the governor's office or the spokesman for the Cabinet for Health and Family Service, simply said that they offered a contract to Sunrise and they have refused it. And this gets back to the teachings of the Kentucky Baptist or the Southern Baptist Convention that basically homosexuality or any kind of gay lifestyle is outside the biblical teachings and viewed as wrong by them.
So what does this mean for the state and vulnerable children?
Well, Sunrise cares for about 1,000 kids a year, according to their website. At any given time, there are about 9,000 to 10,000 kids in the foster care system. So it could put a dent in their capacity and a loss of resources for the state. However, there are multiple providers, some faith-based, some nonprofit, a few for-profit, throughout Kentucky that also provide services. There's the Presbyterian Homes for Children. There's the St. Joseph's here in Louisville. There's just a host of multiple Home of the Innocents. So you know, it's possible they could, I guess, try to absorb the capacity, but I don't know that anyone's figured out exactly what that's going to mean.
So the position of the Southern Baptist hasn't changed on homosexuality, but apparently a decision on how the state would go about accepting that position has changed. What do we know about why that is?
Well, we're not really sure. We just know that's in the contract language. And in past years, Sunrise claims the state has agreed to waive that language, and this year they have not. And they're saying that, the state says their contract language comports with federal law, and that's what they're expecting their contractors to abide by. Now, of course, the administration has changed. Governor Matt Bevin, the conservative Republican, left office, and Governor Andy Beshear is now in, a Democrat, who has indicated, you know, he supports fairness and gay rights. So that could be a shift, but we don't really know what has led to this breakdown.
Deborah Yetter is a reporter with the Louisville Courier-Journal. Deborah, thank you so much for spending some time with us on this Friday. Hope to talk to you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Okay, thank you.
Up next, there's new details emerging in the firing of former Cincinnati Bearcats men's basketball coach John Brannan. And later, a new late-night newscast is coming to a local television station from a media corporation often criticized for its misleading right-wing messaging. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. John Brannan was fired as men's basketball coach at the University of Cincinnati after just two seasons. While questions about all of the circumstances still linger, new details emerged this week thanks to Inquirer reporter Keith Jenkins, who joins us now live via Zoom. Keith, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm doing well. So glad you could be with us to talk more about this unfolding mystery. I mean, you've been around sports a long time. It's unusual, right, for a high-profile athletics program to dismiss a coach with so little information, right?
No, this is unprecedented. You know, I've been around, like you said, sports a long time. I've interviewed folks who have been around sports much longer than I have. And they tell me this is something that they have never seen in their years of covering college athletics, professional athletics. This has been a very weird and unraveling tale and saga. It just seems like each day more and more comes out. But yes, I mean, this is unprecedented, and it just seems to get more and more strange as we go.
So we had talked on this program a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks ago, shortly after Coach Brannan had been fired, about what we knew at that time. And it really wasn't much. You learned more through some reporting that you've done. Talk a little bit about what you found related to John Brannan's firing.
Yeah, so I was able to access the termination letter that the director of athletics at the University of Cincinnati, John Cunningham, sent to John Brannan. And in this letter, it really kind of gave us an idea of where John Cunningham's mind is and was and how he came to the determination that he needed to move on and part ways from John Brannan. In the letter, he said that, you know, Brannan failed to create an atmosphere of compliance and promote an atmosphere of compliance. He disregarded rules and regulations. And then I think, you know, a key of this is he disregarded the well-being, the health and safety of student athletes. This was all according to Cunningham. And then there was a lot of other allegations and accusations from Cunningham to Brannan, which included him paying for or arranging to pay for special benefits for one player, and then even using intimidation to defer other student athletes from making complaints about compliance. So again, these are all allegations and accusations, but again, it paints a picture of why John Brannan was terminated. And I was also able to access a previous reprimand. John Cunningham wrote a reprimand to John Brannan in November about an October practice that Cunningham deemed excessively strenuous. you know, players were falling to the ground till the end of practice. One player needed to receive medical attention at that practice. Now, the weird thing about this reprimand is Cunningham did acknowledge that there were some safe practices in place. There were training staff who were involved. They were there. They were present, making sure that the student athletes were safe and healthy, and that the student athletes were wearing the required heart monitors and also were giving adequate water breaks. So it just seems like, you know, his practices, John Brennan's practices as a coach, was just maybe a little too much and too strenuous and hard in Cunningham's estimation as far as promoting the safety and well-being. And that's ultimately how we came to this.
We're talking with Keith Jenkins, a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. When it was clear that Coach Brennan was probably on his way out at UC, there was speculation, especially after the departure of so many players from the program following the conclusion of the season, that there were some defenders of the coach that said perhaps these players just could not handle how strict maybe he was or how intense he could be in those practices. And so when you revealed that there was this earlier reprimand surrounding a strenuous practice, it seemed to add some clarity or some credibility to suggestions that this was just a different kind of coach than perhaps these players were used to. But we still don't have a whole lot more specifics, even from players, right?
Yeah, there's been exactly. A lot of players haven't gone too specific as to what took place. But there was a report that came out recently that kind of dove a little bit more into some of the details. It paints a picture of John Brennan being very paranoid as far as what John Cunningham and the athletic training staff knew about what's going on. You're required to only practice a certain amount of hours. It's been painted that maybe John Brennan was stretching that and trying to bend the rules and trying to keep that away from the administration. Again, these are all hearsay and allegations. But it paints a picture of a coach who, you know, and you got to remember, all of this was done underneath the umbrella of being a global pandemic, right? Where we're supposed to be hypersensitive of the health and safety of these student athletes, even more so than ordinarily. So during all of this, he was doing a lot of things, allegedly, keeping athletes from, you know, telling the authorities and the administration that I did this and I did that, and using intimidation factors and keeping that quiet and keeping that a secret. And then the interesting part is there was a report out there that John Brennan may have bribed some student athletes. His attorney quickly countered that and said that is false. His attorney came out and said what John Brennan did, in fact, was pay $135 for one of his players' mental health care. He felt that, according to his lawyer, John Brennan felt that the psychologist who was under contract with the University of Cincinnati was not adequate enough to properly treat his player. So he sought another psychologist, paid for that $135 to help the young man get the help that he needed. Now, even though that's a good deed and that's something awesome that, you know, John Brennan allegedly did for his student athlete, it's against the rules. He's not allowed to pay for stuff like that. He has to go through the channels. And if he seeks to go away from those channels, he then needs to properly communicate that to the administration, including the athletic director, John Cunningham. And he didn't do that. So his lawyer basically admitted to breaking a rule. But this is just going to keep going, and they're going to go to court next. That's the next step as John Brennan fights to get the money that he's owed.
So we know now, based on remarks from attorney Tom Mars, who is representing John Brennan, that the coach apparently paid $135 out of his own pocket so that one of the players at UC could see a mental health professional because there was no psychologist on staff, according to this attorney at UC, that could provide the services that they deemed were necessary. Now, when you look at the termination letter and you see something that might reference a bribe or, illegal payment, that raises a lot of eyebrows because we have seen very serious violations of those clauses across college basketball, cars, bags of money, tickets for parents, and that sort of thing. This is $135. So while it is a violation, it's not as serious as some others have seemed. So how, what else do we expect to match up to the more broad and vague references in that termination letter when they become more illustrated by people like Attorney Tom Mars?
Yeah, I think that's what we're waiting to find out. Now, the next thing is any day now, any minute now, Tom Mars and John Brennan are expected to file a lawsuit against the University of Cincinnati. As of right now, John Brennan has been fired with cause. So the $5.25 million that he's owed, University of Cincinnati refuses to pay him that, and he wants his money. So they're going to sue to get his finances, and we're going to see the specifics of truly what happened and what University of Cincinnati can prove as cause to not give John Brennan that money. The interesting thing of all this is, regardless of how this thing unfolds, I think John Brennan is going to have an uphill climb as to getting work. Even if it comes out that, hey, ethically and legally, we found that, you know, you did nothing wrong. Maybe you stretched the rules and bend the rules, but you didn't break any of them. You know, be that as it may, and again, we'll see what happens. But if that is the case, there was still a situation where six players in his program no longer wanted to play for him, seven, including a guy who left during the season and then went to play professionally in Lithuania. And then there was a player who left last season. So, you know, something is happening as far as John Brennan and his ability to properly connect with this generation of athlete. I've talked to former athletes, you know, older athletes who played at the University of Cincinnati. I myself am a former athlete, and we all kind of said, wait, this is the allegations. But I think it's important to note that what maybe was accepted when we were younger and we were at least that age, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, it's just a different time. And it's, you know, maybe a rough practice, a hard practice, you know, where we're falling down and we're having pains and da, 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 da. That was the norm when we were, you know, actively playing sports. It's just changed now. And it's a different scene. And there's different requirements. And then also there's a global pandemic when you need to be super, super cautious of what you're doing and how you're doing it. But yes, as this thing continues to unfold, we're going to learn more and more. And next up is getting in front of a judge and seeing what they can prove.
Because Coach Brannon is owed, according to his attorney, more than $5 million. This is part of a buyout that is pretty standard in large athletics programs at the collegiate level for coaches who may be dismissed ahead of the expiration of the contract, right?
Yeah, I mean, John got a very favorable deal. And it makes you perk up your eyes and go, man, why would you give this kind of contract? And again, this wasn't John Cunningham's hire. John Cunningham was not the athletic director when John Brennan was hired. He was hired after John Brennan. So that's another, you know, interesting tidbit to remember. John Brennan is not John Cunningham's coach. But the contract for John Brennan is very favorable in that if he is let go, which he was, he gets a lot of money, and he was given a lot of money, a big contract for a guy. Again, I like John Brennan. I think he's a great coach. I think he's a great offensive mind. But for someone of his resume and someone who was at this level of his career, he got a very, very, very favorable contract. And that contract is now kind of biting the University of Cincinnati in its rear as this thing unfolds. But they owe him a lot of money. But I mean, look, they've moved on. They've hired a new coach. They've got a new roster and they're preparing for this upcoming season without John Brennan. But John Brennan is not moving on. He wants his money and he's dug his feet in the ground and he's not going anywhere.
Keith Jenkins is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Keith, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. I do hope we can talk again.
My pleasure.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our weekly news review now with WVXU reporter Becca Costello. Hi, Becca.
Michael.
So Election Day was just on Tuesday, and voters gave some new powers to city council as soon as those votes are authorized, of course, and confirmed. And it looks like that new power is already close to being deployed. So give us the background.
Yeah, so voters approved a couple of charter amendments on Tuesday. One of those was introduced by council member Betsy Sunderman. Now, these were introduced at a time when three council members had been arrested on federal corruption charges over the past year. But after this was approved to go on the ballot, a fourth council member was arrested on very different charges. But those charges do fall under the guidelines of the new charter amendment, which basically gives city council the option to suspend a member who's been indicted on felony charges related to their job on council. So what has happened this week is, as soon as the election results were in on Wednesday morning, Betsy Sunderman filed a letter with the council clerk's office asking to suspend or schedule the hearing to potentially suspend Councilmember Wendell Young, who is that fourth council member. He's been charged with a tampering with records charge. This is related to the case all the way back in 2018 and those Gang of Five text messages. He has pled not guilty, but she is seeking to use this new charter amendment power to suspend Young from council.
What she wanted to change was the way council members are suspended. We should note we do have two current council members who are not at council meetings because they are suspended, and there are people in their place currently serving on council. So what was the old process? What is the new process?
Well, this adds a third option, so it doesn't get rid of the other options to suspend a council member. And you mentioned the two that are currently suspended, P.G. Sittenfeld and Jeff Pastor. In their cases, they both voluntarily accepted a suspension from the Ohio Attorney General. That is one option for suspension. The other is to go through the Hamilton County court system, which can be kind of lengthy. And that was the reason Sunderman proposed this charter amendment, was we need something that's faster and that we can do without sort of these outside groups and depending on them to be willing to pursue these suspensions. So this just adds the third option to allow council to do it internally.
All right. And so what is the process playing forward next? I mean, what does our timeline look like? The votes have to be certified, of course, but how eager are we expected to see any type of action at council on this?
Well, that's right. We do have to wait for the votes to be certified. Now, there's it's likely that they will be certified. The measure passed with about 77% approval of the voters. So it's a very clear victory there. That can take about 10 days from Election Day is the estimation. And then from there, the way the charter amendment is written is there could be a special meeting scheduled of council, but Sunderman says she thinks that that's not necessary. They'll just put it on the next full council meeting, which are held on Wednesday afternoons. Councilmember Young will have a chance to basically speak on his behalf and talk about why he feels he should not be suspended. He could have legal representation do that instead. And then there will be a vote of council. Now, it requires there's a 9 members on council, and it requires 7 votes to approve the suspension. And Councilmember Young will be ineligible to vote. So really only one council member could choose to vote against the suspension, and it would still go forward. But it's not clear if there are the votes on council to, 7 votes to suspend Councilmember Young. So that's the piece that is still up in the air.
Okay. So just to reiterate that, 9 members of council, if Councilman Young is, would have to be recused from participating in the vote, that takes it down to 8, but you would still need 7 votes. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. 7 votes to approve the suspension.
Okay. So the final vote could be 7-1 and a suspension would take place. But if one other person were to dissent and it made it 6-2, it would not go through?
That's correct. And he would remain on council and fully able to vote and introduce legislation and everything else.
We're talking with WVXU reporter Becca Costello. Let's talk about money, Becca. I know that's what was going on at City Hall this week as well, as the city starts to figure out how it's going to be spending some of the federal stimulus money. $134 million expected in the city's coffers. What did we learn this week about the city's priorities for this cash?
Well, I'm thinking of this kind of as a good news, bad news situation for this federal stimulus money. So we're talking about the American Rescue Plan, which is the latest federal stimulus coming from the federal government. The good news is that we're getting a little bit more than we initially expected. So Cincinnati is expecting about $311 million total from the American Rescue Plan. About half of that will come as soon as next week. The other half won't come for another year. But the bad news is that the city is using most of the money to stabilize the budget, so fill deficits for this fiscal year and the next couple of fiscal years. And those estimates in terms of the deficit are a lot bigger than what we initially expected. So you mentioned we've got that more than $134 million was approved at council this week. $107 million of that was just to fill deficits. So that's for the fiscal year that ends at the end of June of this year, but also the next fiscal year that starts July 1st. So really the huge bulk of that is just to stabilize the budget and not anything of the support programs that we've been talking about since then. Now, the rest of the funding, about $17.5 million, has been approved for some support programs that Mayor John Cranley and City Manager Paula Boggs-Meezing had proposed. Now, there had been some criticism early on, and that honestly has continued even up through the vote, that these proposals were made without any input from the public or any input from council. And so at the same time, council members said they acknowledge that this is important. These programs are for things like grants to restaurants and bars. And the point was made that, you know, the best time for that restaurants and bars to have that money is over the summer when people are going to be going out again and as vaccinations start to roll out. So that it was important to kind of get that approved as soon as possible. So that's where we are now. And again, back to the bad news, it means that there's really not as much left for council members to kind of divvy up to what they want to spend things on. So we're really left to only about $34 million, $35 million for this year in that federal stimulus left to spend.
And to follow what City Hall does with that, follow Becca Costello, WVXU reporter. You can hear her reporting right here on 91.7 FM or read it at your leisure at WVXU.org. Becca, thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too, Michael.
And let's wrap up this weekly news review now with WVXU Media Beat writer John Keysweater. Hey, Keys, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing well. I know you're excited about this $30 million development under the WLWAM tower. Why is this tower significant, and what is this development?
The tower is significant because that's where WLW has broadcast from since 1928. And the little rectangular building that people drive by on Tylersville Road is where the parts of the transmitter from 1934, when WLW was the only 500,000-watt commercial station in the United States from 34 to 1939. So there's a lot of history on the property. And there's a $30 million development that under the tower and around the transmitter building and the caretaker's house, they're going to put in 24 buildings, four restaurants, office, daycare, a mini warehouse, self-storage, a convenience store with gas station, maybe a car wash, a bank, and other things. And they started in the past couple of weeks ripping out the big trees, these big, huge pine trees that used to line the driveway of the gated complex, so they can put in the road and the roundabout and start and have they'll have a couple of the buildings and companies up and running yet this year.
You refer to this as the Blaw Knox Tower and write that it's one of only six left in the United States.
Yeah, the tower. It basically, when they built it, it's 746 feet. And basically, they took two radio antennas and welded them together, which gives it the diamond shape. And there's only six of them. And it's quite powerful. I was just emailing a WLW retiree who served in Vietnam. And he said in the 60s, when the airways and the skip was right, he could pick up WLW during the Vietnam War in Vietnam.
Oh, man. So, I mean, this is a station that has such a significant history to broadcasting across the country. And so this is a significant piece of architecture. But just to reiterate, there's this huge development going up around it, but the tower will remain.
The tower remains. iHeartMedia, which now owns WLW and a bunch of stations across the country, when they hit budget crunch in recent years, they solved part of their red ink by selling off their real estate. So the WLW transmitter tower and a second little tower will be fenced in, and the rest of the property around it will be developed for, like I said, 24 buildings, a little strip center and commercial and retail area. And they've done the same thing at WSB in Atlanta. There is some concern of the roads being kind of close to the big guy wires that hold up the or stabilize the antenna. And I don't know about you, but I hear from people who have worked at radio stations, you don't want to be parked too close to the tower when the icicles start falling off of it.
That's for certain. And thankfully, there are other people in our organization here who take care of that, and bless them for doing that so that we get to do the cool thing of just talking on the air, which is fun. So thank you for that report. Let's talk about what's happening with Sinclair Broadcasting. This is a somewhat controversial, large media corporation with a presence all across the country. They own Channel 12 and Channel 64 here in Cincinnati, but they're known for a lot of misinformation designed to push right-wing talking points. And they launched this National Desk program that's coming to town.
Well, they actually launched a morning show called the National Desk from 6 to 9 a.m. and it's on Channel 12.2. And it was so under the radar that honestly, it skittered past me. And this week they announced that they're going to do a second version of the National Desk from 10 p.m. to midnight on 68 stations, including all their CW channels, which would include 12.2 here, and the My Network TV stations that they also own. Sinclair owns and operates 12 and 12.2, which is CW Cincinnati, and Star 64. And then up in Dayton, they've got 45 and 22 as well.
So what can we expect from this newscast?
Well, they've been, in the past year, they've really kind of tried to rebrand themselves, and they promote this national newscast, which uses national news, but also taps into reports from local stations that they own from coast to coast as a commentary-free news from both a local and national perspective that's anchored in Washington. And I figure that I've been busy with a lot of other things. The morning show kind of skittered past me, but I'm going to start watching it closely and watching to see how they start with their national newscast on September 27th. But what I'll tell you also is that WGN, and which on cable is WGN America, last September, they launched a national newscast in prime time. And the ratings haven't been real good for it. And they're still, you know, they thought they could do just a straight news, no commentary, no, you know, because those channels that we call cable news in the evening, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News and Newsmax and other, it's not really news. It's commentary all evening. You'll get some news during the day, but most of the time it's, you know, Hannity and Tucker Carlson and Rachel Maddow. That's commentary. That's not news.
So WGN, as you noted, did try to find a place in the market for people who at that time of night might like to just watch a newscast. And it turns out that the audience is not responding.
Exactly. And there'd been long time talk with the competitor Sinclair of starting a cable news channel or a news channel to compete with Fox. And they're going this route where they're launching, as I said, 3 hours in the morning. And now they're going to add 2 hours in the evening. And we'll see where that, you know, if their expansion goes beyond that. But they've got to find an audience first to support the 2 hour evening newscast.
We're talking with WVXU Media Beat writer John Keysweater. Let's talk about the sad news out of American Idol, one of our local favorites. She's from Perryville, Kentucky, of course, but was a student at Northern Kentucky University. Her name is Alyssa Ray. She made it pretty far into American Idol. It's been a while since a local contestant made it this far.
She made it to the top 10. And, you know, Michael, I've been watching these shows. It surprised me that Kelly Clarkson won the first season of American Idol in 2002. Yeah. So that's almost 20 years. And I thought that definitely Alyssa Ray, who's an NKU freshman from Perryville, was probably the most talented local singer that I've seen on the show. But I really thought she had a shot to make it to the final. She reminded me an awful lot of Jennifer Hudson. But also, you got to remember that Jennifer Hudson didn't win American Idol. She only made it set to the seventh place, whereas Alyssa didn't make it to the top seven this past Sunday.
Yeah, so I mean, we've seen past seasons of American Idol where perhaps if you didn't, you might have finished runner-up or even farther back in the rounds and go on to have a more storied career than the person who took the crown that year.
Yeah, Jennifer was seventh, and that was the year that Fantasia Barrino won and came out neck and neck with Diana DeGarmo. So, but I really think that Alyssa will have, she's got a bright future ahead of her. She was very talented. She had a musical theater background. She had been in Sister Act and Little Shop of Horrors and other shows. But I think what worked against her on this show, as talented as she was, every couple of years, they always change how you vote on American Idol. And this, they used to be, you voted as soon as the show was over and they had a results show. Well, now they do it that they open the voting at 8 o'clock when the show starts and it ends when the last person sings. Well, so they're encouraging America to vote for your favorite singer before they sing. And if you're in the second half of the show, you can't pick up some voters who were impressed with your performance as easily as the people who were on the first hour. And in fact, all three people sent home last Sunday were people in the second hour. And a third factor with her is she's from Perryville. Have you ever been to Perryville?
Well, yeah, it's small. You don't have
a
big base.
I had to look it up. It's 10 miles west of Danville and about 48 miles southwest of Lexington.
I think that's where Kentucky's most famous Civil War battle took place.
So the population is 751. So it's not like she had a big city or Southern California or New York City or Orlando or Miami to all rally around her and root for her. She had a, you know, if everybody in the hometown voted 10 times, great. And she had some publicity here from Northern Kentucky going to NKU. But all that said, I think it would be interesting to see if she drops out and goes to a career or she stays at school. I'd certainly love to see her at a NKU production in the next year. Wouldn't surprise me if one of the many theater groups around here tried to attract her and give her a role and used it would help her and help that theater production when theater productions resume.
Well, we always manage to, every few seasons, have a local connection to that program. I still remember, what was the young man, Eben. He's still out there, you know, trying to make it in the business. He was very young on the program and is... he's got a nice look to him and he's still out there working. I follow him on Twitter and I'm trying to think of anybody else off the cuff here who
there was the guy from the Kings Island area who sang at Kings Island, who was on The Voice.
He was on The Voice. Yeah. We had him on. Yeah. He was great too. We got a lot of talent around here and we can always count on you to bring it to our attention. John Kieswetter is the WVXU media beat writer. John, thanks for being with us today. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
And don't forget, the cicadas are also on their way. You can learn everything you need to know about Brood 10 on the Brood 10 podcast brought to you by WVXU Radio. You can listen to the episodes featuring Dr. Gene Kritsky from Mount St. Joseph University and our very own Corey Sharber at WVXU.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This theme song composed by Rob Fetters. And archives are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.